Is there a Windows screen up there? No, it's still Mac.
Just be patient. There it is. There it is. No, you had it.
I didn't do anything.
Okay, you switched. So you didn't do anything. Pull the mouse up.
Don't you love technology? This is a mystery game called Clues. And the object of the game is to explore as many different places as possible and uncover clues to help solve the mystery. And I'm going to let you make the choices and see if you can find the clues. And fabulous prizes await anybody who gets it right. So choose carefully. I'm going to skip over the introductory section here so we'll have more time to play. But our first choice involves three doors here. The first one is labeled of the door. And this is in the door or out the door. So which of the three choices should we make here at the outset? Anyone have a preference? In the door? Out the door. Maybe we should vote. Who wants to go in? Who wants to go out? Well, I think the ins have it this time. Okay, so this is our first chance at solving, at uncovering a clue here. We have the babe over here who asks, want some, having known. And the text is, the body's a slippery customer. It operates somewhere between the mind and the rest of the world. The middleman for self and other, dealer in appearances, lust runner, pain pimp, speculator in mortality. What of its propositions, its flesh and blood theories of love and death? Want me to fill in your blanks for you? So, do we want some, or should we check out the guy on the floor here? Want some. Aha, all right, that's the first clue. This well-built hypothesis is too much for any man. You can bet that when it's put forward, the probability of the lights will be low, the music soft. After it's checked the premises to make sure you're alone there, it will have you at its mercy with its lips inches from your luck and its hand lightly stroking your corollaries. You'll know you're beyond hope when it makes itself at home and starts to redecorate. It will never quite breach the bounds of the possible, but oh, the things it will hang on those walls, the pictures that conduct their scenes like experiments, the clock fraught with precarious hours, the curtains that are pure opening. It can accessorize life's better propositions before you even realize they've been made. Yet nothing can mitigate the unsightly certainty of next week's back door with its escape clauses. Oh, God, is it likely? But to it, you'll be just another stretch of the imagination, a one-night shot in the dark. So when you wake the following day with the morning sunlight up in the air, you'll find yourself alone to nurse the painful gray area. Nothing hurts quite like unrequited probability. So here we've got you, back door, next week's back door, or one night shot in the dark. Dark. Everybody wants dark. There's nothing sadder than light gone bad. The dark graft, the slow corruption, the shapes sacrificed one by one like principles. You want to keep believing in it, but will that make you an accessory? So do we believe, or do we go on to the next room? Next room. The age of belief is over, apparently. The uncertainty principle, the slippery waves and particles of self. Can you ever find out who you are without becoming someone else? Through the lens, for the record, out the door, or to the next room?
For the record.
For the record. Oops. Identity contains no data. The device CU is not accessible. You could have tripped the shutter, been captured on the sensitive silver halide of simile, but you left your image in the logo chemistry, but you blew it. Next time, be more careful. Well, that wasn't it. And we're back where we were before, but you'll notice the guy behind the chair is gone. So we're left with the next room or out the door.
Next room.
What lies beneath the pretty wrappings of quickly glimpsing, half understanding, vaguely desiring? Then who? What if? Okay, who wants this one? Then who? Three people. Who wants what if? Oh, a whole bunch of people. Well, this is a pretty sharp group. Clue number two. It's larger than life. Or rather, bigger than the box life comes in before it's assembled. Watch closely. It's the color of trying to see, so it blends into each look. It's the shape of the mind and fits perfectly into whatever you're thinking, no matter how sharp the edges. Just about grasped it? Well, it has the feel of almost touching, so you'll never know when it's in your hands, despite, don't drop it for God's sake. Let's try again, and pay attention this time. The trick is to deceive appearances. Look things in the face value while you grope for their privates under the table. Get your feelings to trust you so they'll slip you past the checkpoints. Then, when nobody's looking, flip to the last page of your soul to feel the outcome. That's right, your soul. The quaint old medium that stores whatever's left over after the world has downloaded the hard you data. No, not that page. The one that never gets written. Okay, once more from the beginning. You data. Aha, okay, we get another chance at our friend here. Through the lens. Interpretation will have its way with strangers in these parts, so tread suggestively. Keep your pronouns unbuttoned a little to attract attention. A roving eye, though it must persist in the face of great anonymity, may be just the thing to put the puzzle in someone's perspective. Let the pieces notice you. Look. Over there, where there's nothing to see, that's solid evidence that what's of interest is elsewhere. And maybe you're it. So stay sharp, Why, just the other day, the sun broke through a clouded issue, but no one was there to be brought to light. When identity is wasted like that, the page may never get filled. But the poem goes on, and if you massage the lines just right, you may prove to be your own best metaphor for whoever it is you actually are. So we have a door at the bottom. We have clouded issue. Those are the only two on this page.
Clouded issue.
Clouded issue. Okay, we're back here. Let's just head out to somewhere different here. You expected maybe special delivery or a singing telegram? It comes the way it comes. Are you ready to root through the bulk mailings of the mind to track down the missed deliveries of Memory Express? Think inside the box, or do not push the envelope. Do not push the envelope. Oh, general introspection fault. That's a bad one. You reached inside yourself, and your mind, that steel trap, snapped shut on your fingers. Opportunity makes good its escape. You felt sorry for it, didn't you? Deliberately let it slip away. You thought, what deserves its freedom more than chance? Yeah, sure you did. Maybe next time you'll listen when you're told not to push the envelope. And the letter here is from the Authorial Beyond Plotline Department to False Hope, care of the Red Herring. So, how are we doing for time?
5 minutes.
Okay, one more then. Okay, so we're finally out of the room here. We can hit the road. We can head into the trees, or into the trees on the other side. Into the trees. It dings every time you click on the button, doesn't add much to the soundtrack. The tree-encoded wind, rustling, musty. What's conveyed in the glyphs of leaf and in the erasures between them? And here there's only one option. This is a freebie clue. So this will be the last one. Clue number 4. A nervous look left on her face, a fingerprint on the edge to his voice. A footprint by that last suspicious loneliness. These aren't the things to focus on. True, if you keep your eye on the context, you may catch some careless details in the act, but you'll never be able to force the forest out of the trees. It's better to unleash the bloodhounds you've imagined at times when you yourself were fleeing through those trees, knowing that some realities take no prisoners. They'll get on the scent that's never really been left there and lead you through the brush, where you'll find, caught on the branches like telltale shreds of clothing, a filament of breeze, a limp pitch of thrush song, a scrap of lately faded morning light. The day has been by that way. Somewhere ahead, the rest of the scene will be played without you, and you'll never know what's become of your heart-stopping lines. Hold the breeze against your ear. Carefully examine the mindward thrust of the note, and you may find clinging to them the cheers of an audience that's been solved once and for all. Or you may just find the blowing of that breeze and the sounding of that note, undiluted, infinitely, and astonishingly themselves. Thank you.
That work also uses the Word Circuits connection system, which is a JavaScript system that makes links combinatory in different ways from your standard web link. And it's great work, Rob. I like it a lot. Anyway, our next reader, Talon Mehmet, is the winner of the 2001 Trace Alt X International New Media Writing Competition. And I do have a few announcements while Talon is coming up and getting ready with the new haircut. Tomorrow night, the reading is actually at 7 o'clock. In the program, I think it says 7:30 or something like that. There isn't a van tonight, but I wanted to let you know that Westwood is actually safer than any neighborhood in Chicago. It's actually safer than Providence, Rhode Island, if you can believe that. And it's a very pleasant night, so walking back shouldn't be an issue. There's many bistros on the way. But there will be vans tomorrow for the readings going from the Hammer and back to the hotels. And also we have 8 tickets available still for the banquet tomorrow, which should be a lot of fun. And I understand the cuisine at the Doubletree is to be envied by the cuisine at the Howard Johnson's. And no, it's supposed to be very good. Yeah, did I say tomorrow? Yeah. It's all one day, man. And we'll also have the timetable for the gallery tomorrow morning. So if any of you are interested in seeing what works are featured at what time, you can find that as a printed handout, another piece of paper with words on it. So anyway, Talon, I understand you haven't decided what you're going to read tonight.
I'm going to read a poem.
You're going to? Okay.
Well, I sent in 2 pieces, so. And I was going to read Translucidity, so I'll open that one. But I also sent in Birth of Venus, so I'm going to read that one too. Let's start with Translucidity. The local screen, face of any other, is complicated, serving as both entrance to and exit from the body of Par 2, the body in which Par 1 makes its deposit, request, and as the face of the pro-rejective sub-object, the shared child. Identity at the terminal may be questionable, but the familial genetic work is made more stable by the sharing of access and location. Par 1 develops an offspring, an entity that is inconsistent with the qualities of the shared child of the Par 1, 2, or Par 1, Par 2 coupling. Par 2 doesn't care. The offspring extends the genealogy of the pro-rejective sub-object by simulating an ID entity for it that is socialized elsewhere from the elsewhere of the network, within without the bracketed coupling. The attachment of the shared child is exclusive to either transparental terminal and differs substantially one to the other, where Par 1 develops a transmediated offspring for the shared child, making it real through use value. Par 2 doesn't care. Let's go into Birth of Venus for a moment. Cronus castrates Uranus, sky falls, C, X, Uranus at C. Air, foam, agitation, irritation, cultivation, form, birth. Some formula that I won't read. And I'll just click through this screen. Lowest tide, highest tide, seashore. The shell opens, and she is served up properly steamed and salted. At C, plus C, F, V, giving form to formula, or fomula, The prefacial program is represented by the agent of its narrative sum. Foam, border skirmishes between liquid and gas, the commingling and agitation of air with water, to the point at which water is nothing but surface, and air is only vacancy. Water the vessel, air its contents. Let's go back to translucidity. And I'm sure this is not lucid to many. Par 2 is not concerned with the consistency of par 1, of the par 1 offspring. V plus double articulation equals Deleuze and Guattari. The Medici appropriate and exploit the conductive aspects of Venus as a prospective cure for the medieval, suturing the then to the next. Nutrition fracs. These are various nutritional supplements, each one representative of the Venus forms that are used here. I think this one is, from what's in it. This is probably energy and sexual function. This is well-being, and this is energy as well. Looking back through ages dark and golden, one, cut off communications and affiliations, privilege one party over another. Two, appropriate tools and weapons, construct the timeless cyborg I+ device. Progress. Three, cultivate future culture cults, spread the word, hope to be remembered. Z, again, 400 to 500 years later, the packet arrives, overheard, over breakfast, over brunch, a 2-martini lunch, over a bed of rice. Her mood changes when I suggest sushi for breakfast. Face, name, name, face to name. I was never any good at that, remembering one to another, placing face to place. The packet arrives, falling to the table in an orgy of packing peanut pooty, marshmallow canopies. And then that cycles through. We'll close the birth of Venus. George enters. In consideration of the never birth of the par 1, par 2 combinatory child, and that every user represents a par 1 to the par 2 of the network, the potential combinations, couplings, and collectives formed between bodies, the sub-objective capacity of par 2 is astounding. On the other hand, the fecundity of par 1, the desire and will to get what one wants out of the familial network, par 1's seeking and seeding of any every sub-object through the apparatus is equally incredible. She appears, fresh local flesh is mine now, all face to gathered. I search, I am searching, I'm constantly re-dismembering myself to my own identity, there, here, corresponding and combining, there, here. I am searching the deposition and reacquisition of myself. I have been there before. She is in charge, predicts my impulse. Mesmerized by the face, I forget the entrails and electronic viscera of which she is made, that she is pure device. I forget the way. I don't know the way. I've never been away, never through to elsewhere. I'm not that sensitive, lost to conductivity without contact, the evaporation and electrification of a body into currency. I return to the face as the focus of both the fixation and vexation, vexation as what I seek and seed, to return face to at body, the radiance of a dual narcissistic conduction, get post, expenditure and acquisition is fairly easily maintained through the apparatus, and it becomes obvious that the allure of the face, rather, its request in return, is the force, the friction that produces the seductive glow, the continuation that allows for continuation. Allure, I have what you want. Show me. Please register. Who are you? let's just fake it. Lure, I need to know, to hear a no before a yes, lure. The lure is the gateway, nothing more, and there is so much more beyond the threshold. In the crevices of any every rite or culture, there has to be a first step, a first time, a riddle is offered that must be solved, begs to be solved, and I believe I am the one to solve it, that I know as much. The allure, the glow is pale, porcelain with dark and seedy eyes. She wears the face of the criminal. Though she rests and rarely speaks, her action transforms the common and banal, brightens the sun with radiance both fraudulent and inspired. Allure is confirmed in the action of deposition, or deposition. The input of I elsewhere, the production of a double, a data self that insinuates progress to the apparatus by establishing agential colonies, left in the dark, unfolding inner flesh. Lured to another, lured, pulled under, down, below, plunged in, there, elsewhere, plunged under, beneath, translucidate, bring a like, a double, unfold, do trick, she shows real emotion, simulates, deceives. Body at front. I am my own application. I develop and sustain this community, commodity. We develop and sustain this. We common expatriates, compatriots, common expiates, com-expiates, we compatriots with most of what determines us located elsewhere, lost from there, from the there and now, or the here and now, the there and no, lose track of the originating terminal, the at body of every transparental assumption and provision of attachment. Have I gone too far? Now I am reaching, making switchbacks as I approach the temple. The gloss and glare gives me a headache. Permission denied. Now, here and now, I am reminded to remember my cadavatars pulled to the terminal to honor and delete the dead-eye heroes of yesterday, former friends of my comradiance, accessories to my previous folly. I am here, I am there, I am we collate I here, collecting pro-sub-objective matter to ourselves to make many one too many, we remember. I worry for the dead. I worry for what they say of me. How the I that I have forgotten will betray me. Forgotten, forsaken, loss of interest. The end of face. Twilight. Cess, press, gress. X behind beyond setting. I repeat, sod, crisscross, previous crossings, previous progressions and processions and sessions. Our attachment and remembrance is given dimension, as is the infra-ultrastructure, through the conjoining of separate micro-reasoned networks. Meaning, what emerges from the montage in the there and now, the here and now, is constructed through receptive encodings of intent, mitigating the potential for unfamiliarity at the terminal. The faciality of the interface is reduced to facilitator, device without being. I, we become the vacancy, the mark and membrane between the included and the excluded, drawing lines in a polluted sky, dancing sweet across the sands. Thing. Easing into extremes, getting everything gets easier. Below, slip, liquid, Ioceanus surround eye. Above, slip, return to flesh. The face is blank, a blank stare. Waiting is to parrot and repeat. It doesn't matter what. Signal, the neon signal, the message, blue and sober. Everything is thought of in advance. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Well, Talon's taken a lot of risks, a lot of artistic risks with his work, and he's followed by somebody who takes just as many or even more risks. some of which you can see in the installation in the room behind us, a work about Anna O. Freud's Brewer's muse, who is Freud's muse, that is activated by your body and by your voice, and a pretty incredible piece that took, I'd imagine, an amazingly large amount of time to complete. And this work that he's going to be showing now, The Impermanence Agent, is another work about things that are impermanent. And many things are impermanent on the web. I'm sure some of our panels in the next couple days will touch on that. But Nick is going to try to read from this work that is almost indescribable by anyone but Noah Wardrup Frun.
Actually, as a kindness to Nick, I've agreed to do it myself. So he'll be pleased by that, I have a feeling. Oh, perhaps I've overshot. All is well, he said. Luckily, there's only one more reader after me, so however much damage I do to the equipment, I think it'll be fine. So, to give you a little idea, briefly, of what Scott meant about taking risks, The Impermanence Agent is a fiction that alters its text for each user. That means that I've been writing text that's meant to be changed, which is an interesting experience, and changed in ways that I can't entirely predict. So here's an example passage, first mine, and then a couple alterations for other users that I pulled out of the system this morning. A few times Cleveland came, took them to the diner to ask them to ask Mom to come back. The hot chocolate was soap tasting. Once he cried, and Anne told her mother that he was like a crocodile. Eleanor told her not to say those things and smiled. A few times Cleveland came, took them to the diner to ask them to ask Mom to come back. The bilge pump was soap tasting. Once he cried, and Anne told her mother that life is like a crocodile. Eleanor told her sponsors for smiled. A TransLink smart card, the diner to ask them to ask Mom to come back. The module name, date, and the struggle between complexity and simple complexity has a device, which is soap tasting. Once he thinks Intel will survive a crocodile, Eleanor told her time and sent Eleanor with money for the GNU general public license. Is that time, it seems, the particular feature comes in very handy if you were provided by Bay Area transit agencies, and smiled. So this alteration is happening based on what people web browse. We monitor the web browsing of each person who's reading the agent, and we tell our story in a little window. And what story that is collaged with text from their text. And that, you know, makes it a challenge to read. And it's a challenge that I've talked about quite a bit with my collaborators on the project, who aren't here, A.C. Chapman and Brian Moss and Dwayne Whitehurst. Anyway, it's part of an outgrowth of this discussion about how it's hard to read something that's written to be changed and how it's difficult to show something that's supposed to happen over time. Because really, the reading of the agent is about a week-long process, that you leave it open and you can't click on it. It's entirely driven by you going to other websites. What we've done is create a presentation of the impermanence agent's story. So what most people have done up to this point is experience the impermanence agent, which tells you a story. This is a presentation of the story. Don't worry, it starts up slowly, deliberately. And what this piece does, instead of presenting something customized for you, It shows you the entire story at once, customized for multiple different, using customizations from many different users. So what you see is the first piece customized for one person, then customized for another person, then customized for another. The second piece customized for a person, customized for another, customized for another. And this is the first, you know, it's a work in process. This is the first time anyone's seen it. I think this is the audience I'd most like to first show it to. And hopefully it'll be done before too long. So let me read a few altered pieces chosen this morning again from current agent sessions for various people. And they're in an in-between state where they've already changed noticeably from my text, but they're still largely within the shape of the text that I originally wrote. This is what Anne told Joan. Anne, Joan's mother, Cleveland and Eleanor's daughter, when Anne was heard by his mother, met her knees with school in unknown, unmown Florida, a call for the web will be held from the car. They know no hypertext researcher anticipated the DAC dialogue. Tosca and stayed. It was shot while walking to the floor lamp that had ever happened. Mom made breakfast on the two-burner range. Anne would eat looking out into the parking lot. They still went to school. A writer's craft, the diner to ask them to ask Mom to come back, the not-for-profit organization whose mission is soap tasting. Once he called for I wrote updates and emails from her men were trying to make every he was like a crocodile. Eleanor told her authors die and smiled. The Palestinian man was shot while he went back. Willard rode in Cleveland's car. Anne watched it through the windshield, saying, crash, crash, crash. Mom's hand on the steering wheel still puffed green-black. As a political leader's, they was married. As a border checkpoint beat a boy's. On the grass, facing in pairs, shins tucked under, dropping her knees with their pale blue shirt, they called for a budding alliance between Hamas and security in return for ending the military occupation, he, Live, and David, denting their thigh flesh, denim taking her knuckle skin, bruising, they needed help standing, her job listings for arms already knotted before boys got to them, played until the boys got taller. Until the conservatives have argued for a West Bank and the different school, until vowing to expel the Americans from his, it was 1982. Anne, that is her mother's name. This is what happened. It is 1933. The European diplomats met Thursday with the railway auction. The church, fragrant with the blotter. A University of Wales, Aberystwyth, seeks applicants for left-hand writing from Woolworth. Blue ink smeared on the fourth century is their palm. Eleanor is writing the letter that Joan, her attention by hypertext now readers and the gunmen, saying slowly and now. A pea-yellow cardigan hung limp over Eleanor's shoulders, hunched on the piano bench seat. The sense of Grace's round belly tight under her sack dress in the living room, the fine movements of Grace's waiting needlepoint, and Eleanor smiling, Eleanor holding the lot of open areas in the United States that spreads sunshine all over a baby coming. She begins again. Honey boy, Grace is due any time. I call themselves, are obviously prosperous and live in us. We must have divine forgiveness, for each other especially. I love you. You have written me such honest letters. You know it is not joking when walking to the same for me. Not so the other in her frailties. I link, therefore I am. A baby moving today and wanted to tell Grace that I forgive you. That killed 25 people and myself. But even she wrote updates and emails from her family. The way they have religion, it's not forgiving. She was not joking when he said, "There are a University of Wales, Aberystwyth, seeks applicants for the page and turns it." Thank you.
That was great, Noah. Could I get the unknown? Could I get a little unknown up here? Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce, for the first time in a public appearance anywhere, Mr. Frank Marquardt. Dirk Stratton is the one who looks like Mr. Cotter, or that William Gillespie is the man who adheres to the suit-wearing tradition. William is carrying an item for sale. We thought we might give Eastgate a run for their money, so we decided to finally put out that book we've been talking about all these years, The Unknown and Anthology. It's filled with experimental fiction and poetry. You ought to read it. It's only $10. A special symposium price. Anyway, we're going to read from the hypertext novel, The Unknown. Actually, maybe we'll just read from The Impermanence Agent. To be honest with you, it's cooler. Introducing Frank Marquardt.
This is actually the first time, this is the 29th unknown reading, and the first time that all four of the lead unknown writers have appeared together in person, and also the first time we have appeared together with the Unknown Anthology, a print book that is the essential plot gimmick of the hypertext novel.
Not only is it my first time reading with the Unknown, it's actually the first time I've seen this book, so I'm very excited, and in honor of that, I'd just like to encourage you all to open your wallets, to give us the $10 that Scott mentioned it costs to purchase this. It supports the American economy. Literature is the backbone of this economy. If we don't buy literature, we're going to die.
Buy this book.
The Unknown. Toward the end of the millennium, we had published a book of our best writing, and we traveled the world to promote it. We were generally reckless and lucky, and the whole undertaking proved to be very successful. We felt good work, and we deserved to live our dream. Then, after we returned from China, we were offered the opportunity to write a motion picture, and so we moved to Los Angeles. What then happened has been documented elsewhere, but the point is that fame and wealth and very nearly destroyed us. Before the end, one of us had died, another had a kind of epiphany, and I had become the sworn enemy of a number of people who used to find me quite likable.
Oh no, we're not going to let you choose for a little while here. We usually let people choose, but then we find we don't get to read what we want, and we just put out a book.
The trouble with The Unknown is that you have to read it. It's kind of graduate level stuff. But I recommend it to your undergraduate students.
We'll let you choose in a minute. Just give us a minute here. After his death, Dirk shed his corporeal form and floated like a spirit, only not quite, like a soul, but he didn't believe in that. Like a shade, but more the kind you'd sit under a tree than a ghost. Like a what? Like a Jungian archetype? No, like the zeitgeist. That's not it exactly. It is difficult to describe this thing that Dirk was after he had been so brutally slaughtered, pureed on the altar of circumstance, made a sacrificial offering of, carefully excised from the map of human endeavor. No, that's not it. That's too much to say that. For indeed, if anything, his loss was his gain, as it were, in terms of the popular consciousness, in the way that these things happen to artists after they are dead, as it happened to William Gaddis, whose a frolic of his own began flying off the shelves soon after his life force had expired, whose works were suddenly being taught in freshman composition classes the world over. Yes, Dirk, too, this had happened to. As Oprah had the rest of us on her show to promote the anthology and to discuss the latest unknown title, The Teachings of Dirk, as women wearing black veils were gathering in town squares across this great nation and others to mourn, as old men were seen weeping into their steins of domestic beer, as Clinton, nearly out of office, himself offered words of reconciliation and condolence, as children everywhere, boy child and girl child, born fresh unto the earth, were newly baptized Dirk and Dirkina and Dirkel and Strat, as an amateur astronomer working late into the night, gazing at the stars in between line breaks of the bland taste, spotted a new comet in the night sky and assigned it the appellation of Stratton Star. So it went. And this was not a small breath of acknowledgement. This was not 15 minutes of fame. This was hours of it, and it went on, and so it went, and he did not, and he would not fade from it, and his message was spread, and there were many in his tribe as they cried out early in the hallucinogen-drenched mornings, "We are Dirk! We is one!" And it was as if the whole thing had been planned, or rather not planned, but according to a pattern which rose out of the chaos, and children were planting trees in his name. And I am not avoiding here the impossibility of life after death. I am embracing it. For who am I to say, who am I to deny, that Dirk's was a living spirit and one which traveled and soared and sank through multitudes in those early moments of the 21st century, as Dirk was a pilgrim who had finally made it to Mecca, bowing before the great stone at the same time as he was a monk, levitating inches in a monastery in Tibet at the same time as he was a banker, watching his internet stocks come crashing down at the same time as he was an electrician working 24-hour days for weeks on end, as the grid slowly returned to normal function at the same time as he was an Ethiopian with no shoes running across the cracked and barren earth dreaming of distance, at the same time as he was a nun momentarily contemplating a man whom she might have loved had she not taken the vow, at the same time as he was an angry teenager flipping burgers for a national chain and seeing no future in the world we had made, at the same time as he was a note in a song that the whales sang as they sang to each other a song of woe for their brothers who had passed and were dying in the devastated ocean, as part of Dirk occupied the taste buds on the tongue of a three-year-old girl eating an ice cream sandwich for the first time, and another part of him absorbing the pain of an 85-year-old woman as the explosion tore through her home in Kosovo, killing her husband of 60 years as the brick wall came crashing down on his side of the bed. Dirk was in her wail. Dirk was in the streets, dancing with the half-naked crowds in Brazil. Dirk was a woman in the south of France who had just invented a new epistemology. Who is to say that he was not there, that he was not in all of these people, that he was not even in the lemurs in Madagascar? This is what he claimed. This is what he said. This is what he felt. And I would be a liar if I said that I looked into his eyes as he told me these things and did not believe that they were true. There were no scars from pounded nails. There was no fingering of the slices in his sides. But he said what he said with feeling. He said it once more with feeling, and I know that what he said was true.
Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Dirk Stratton. One of the amazing things about hypertext is that it allows the writer multiple pathways when giving a reading. For example,
it's a just investigation. Yeah, that's it. In Los Angeles, nobody's innocent. You can have been Ted 20 years and still be guilty for murders you didn't commit. It might be due to the sun. Its Los Angeles edges are so bright it makes an otherwise idyllic city dark. It cuts through the shit of life, and by making you clear to yourself, it shows you how much dirt you've got in your heart and how much blood on your hands. You don't have to tell me I might be guilty, because I might be. You may think you're innocent when you're in a crowd. A celebration may lead you to feel gay. Music puts the pleasure of life in a person's chest. So what? California isn't the bright edges and happy landscapes a New Yorker might mistake it for. It's as dirty as Chicago, but the dirt isn't as apparent. And you need to know where to go to find it. There's always a hard part. I tell you what to think, and you don't think it. But God started with something or someone, and who's going to knock it? The worst you can say is it's fiction, and if you look into your heart, you'll realize you participate in the same thing every day. It was a murder, bloody and sad. They wanted me to find the killer, boo-hoo. I'd followed the papers. I knew the story as well as anyone, but that doesn't explain why they chose me. Maybe because I was easy. Maybe because they'd heard about my work in times and places past. You don't go looking for reasons unless you have to, and you don't have to unless love or money is involved. I didn't feel any love for Dirk Stratton, but the money was there, and who am I to refuse it? You take the facts of the case because you don't have anything else. Dirk was famous. He was loved. He was the guest of honor in a stadium of admirers. It was a hit, that's for sure. The blood hadn't had a chance to cool, and his eyes were popping out of his head. You could see it on TV. I did the usual investigating. I talked to those closest to the newly deceased. I dusted for prints and ran the battery of DNA tests and mapped out the crime scene. I used the gadgetry available to me at the proper spy stores and under the country at gun shops and specialty dealers and over the internet. But I knew in advance what I'd find. There were too many clues. Witnesses said Scott had threatened the man the night before when they were taking shots of whiskey. He'd gone through a period during which he'd felt increasingly ineffectual, outshined by his former protege. What easier way to take the main stage than to kill him? What better way to restore his self-confidence and writerly swagger? William was off his gurney when it happened, his coma curiously ending about the time of Dirk's murder. It doesn't take two and two to draw a connection. There had been animosity between the two. William had grown angrier and meaner, and some said Dirk was to blame. You don't go around following a cult leader and completely escape psychological damage. Perhaps William's physical problems were a mask for his mental anguish. He could claim insanity in a court of law and get off with time in the loony bin. The judge would believe it. Or he could get away with it the way he'd gotten away with language games and how many stories and poems, crap that nobody caught until he let him know it was there. You can hide a motive one day, and another is clear what it is. And Frank, laughing and jumping around on stage, nobody believed that fucker with his cagey smile. His motive was that of the child who hates his father. He wanted center stage and didn't have it, just like all the others, but worse. He'd been the one who gave Dirk the mind-reading trick when they'd been on tour, and Dirk had taken it, exploited it, and used it to get what secretly everybody knew that Frank guy always wanted. Love from strangers, respect from old friends, approval from a world he did not know. There were other suspects. There was a stadium full of suspects, and every one of them could be guilty. But these three stood out among the others, and I sniffed them like a dog sniffing shit.
Thank you very much. We've set up the first part of the reading so that you might hear all four of the unknown read. This may be your only chance to do that. However, now we are going to surrender to the spirit of our gathering and perform it in a hypertextual manner. So I'm going to start reading this, and then I will, when I'm good and ready, start ringing this bell.
I'll be the bell ringer. Go ahead, read.
Let William ring the bell.
When there are links. So if a link interests you, call out the linked text, and we will skip to that. I had, since my earliest boyhood, been an avid fan of the cinema. Upon reflection, I had never seen a film that I was not, to some degree, satisfied by. All of that was about to change. Trying to force all thoughts of Rettberg's wife from my mind, I made my way into the theater and down the plush aisle toward the front row. The seats were full of people in tuxedos and evening gowns. They were chatting and laughing and drinking Moët Chandon White Star champagne, which was being poured by impeccable wine stewards who moved up and down the aisles. There was the smell of swordfish being prepared for the appetizer. There was to be a five-course gourmet meal served throughout the film. I found myself a little put off by all this. I was, after all, a writer, and, as such, inhabited a different world than these people, the titans of Hollywood, in Los Angeles. I had always considered film as something secondary to literature, a tributary to the great river of literature whose broad and powerful currents had flowed for hundreds of years. Film, I had always thought, existed to make literature richer. The thought that things were the other way around left rather a bad taste in my mouth. I found myself alone in the first row. I suspected that I was the only one here to see the film, and that everyone else was here to be seen seeing the film by such and such famous director or other. Again, I tried to force these cynical thoughts from my mind and tried to enjoy the popcorn. I found, though, that it had been flavored with some kind of garlic butter with capers, and I suspected tricolor pepper. It had a hint of anchovy. I briefly considered returning to the concession stand and demanding normal popcorn, but quickly subdued my irritation. I was here to see a movie, I reminded myself. Nothing more. At last, the film began. The opening scene was set in a bookstore. The camera panned slowly over an anthology shelf. A quick scrutiny of the titles revealed to me that they were not real books. They were spines designed by studio professionals to resemble real books, and there was not a single anthology I recognized, nor did I see anything published by Norton or Dalkey Archive or Sun and Moon Press. I found this bothered me for reasons I could not put a finger on. Finally, the camera rose upward and, in a shot facing downward, panned over the tops of the shelves. The effect was admittedly stunning, that of floating over the ceiling of a bookstore looking down as I had imagined the ghost of Kerouac had so often done.
I think this is Frank. Bing, bang, boo, baby, and smokestacks. Yeah, as we drive down the wide street, this cat is blowing the sax there. And the music is like Zinn steeping in boiling fog, and me and Scott and Dirk are three dilated eyeballs soaking in the Benzedrine gin, floating in glasses like orange shapes. The cigarette sketches out the details against the night. Scott needs a drink, and I feel a poem coming on, and a slow train is like the clicking of a piano. And in this jazz lounge, we run into Frank by accident. This cosmic coincidence has completed the trilogy of reason, and hey, Rama, hair, wow, zibbity, doo, da, day. Then Frank runs out on the street like Groucho Marx, smoking a hooter.
No division of labor whatsoever? I don't think that would work out. There's only so many things you can do like that. For instance, it's very difficult to grow coffee beans in Chicago. I mean, you wouldn't be alienated, so you wouldn't have any Colombian workers, you know, getting paid peanuts for coffee beans, but...
If you wanted a home computer, you would have to design and build and program it yourself, which would be hard, but...
That would make people's lives very short, William.
Why?
Because they'd get on these projects, and that's all they'd ever do. Say I'm going to design some kind of a multimedia VRML workstation. I'd have to gather all the materials and blow the glass for the monitor tube or gather the liquid crystal for the liquid crystal display. it would get very complicated and time-consuming, and we wouldn't have the kind of sophisticated technology we have today. I think people should be more concentrated on sharing their labor rather sort of than this Hobbes thing you got going on, dog eat dog, don't be divided from your labor, divide and conquer kind of Hobbesian.
It's also kind of a vaguely Marxist and Buckminster Fullerish kind of notion that we had to have a lousy society in order to get to the kind of society that we want. So things like the highway system were built for people to drive their own car and be alienated from the wilderness and from their fellow travelers. Even though it was a bad idea, it was necessary so that we could have the highway system, which will now be the public bicycle paths that I described earlier.
So are you trying to say that these Asian longhorn beetles infesting the trees all over the Chicago area, eating them from the inside, turning them into firewood, that's a good...
That whole fear of Y2K thing turned out to be pretty overblown. There are some pretty major systematic fuck-ups, don't get me wrong, but the world hardly came grinding to a halt. The problems came where people least expected them. All the banks were fine, so that last-minute rush to withdraw funds that nearly itself created a financial catastrophe of, well, catastrophic proportions was premature. Some systems did go out, like people's gas in Chicago, the heating gas. People never thought something as seemingly low-tech as the heating would be affected by this ubiquitous computer problem, but there you have it. This would have been a major crisis because it was so cold, were it not for the fact that during 1998-99, all of the city's trees had been infested with Asian longhorn beetles, which meant plenty of firewood was available right on the streets. Mayor Daley saw to it that wood-burning stoves were distributed on every corner, free of charge. There were bonfires in the street. People were dancing and sharing home-cooked meals. A lot of beef stew was served to neighbors from Dutch ovens, and hot cocoa with peppermint schnapps. No more people die than usually die during a harsh winter, and after a week, the gas was back on, and everything had pretty much returned to normal.
That one's kind of lame.
What is it?
It was the Kurt White page. What for the? This is the last. We're getting like the cutoff sign, meaning everybody's got to go to the bathroom and, well, have another drink or go to the bathroom. So what we're going to do is whoever shouts the person's name the loudest, as we scroll through the names. We can do that. Let's switch paragraphs and just call this a... During the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low, the unknown had been passing together on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country in Maryland, and at length found themselves, as the shades of the evening drew on, within view of the melancholy house of John Barth. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable metafiction pervaded Dirk's spirit. I say insufferable, for the feeling was unrelieved by any of that half-pleasurable because poetic sentiment with which the mind receives even the sternest natural images of storytelling or the storyteller. We looked upon the scene before us, upon the mere house with the boathouse and the gray sea behind us, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant eye-like windows, upon a few rank marijuana plants, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees with the utter depression of soul which I can compare to no earthly sensation more properly to the after-dream of the reveler upon opium. The bitter lapse into everyday life, the hideous dropping of the veil.
Dirk groaned and the horses neighed. We tied them onto the thing onto which you tie horses so that they might lap at the trough of murky gray water and yet not prance away into the inky day. I forget what such a thing is called, but I remember that Barth had one, most conveniently. The horse post?
So this is Baltimore? Oh.
Our asses were sore as we were unaccustomed to riding horses. Scott groaned as well.
What of John Barth?
The spry old man ran up to greet us.
William paused to think. What was it that so unnerved him in the contemplation of John Barth?
John Barth gave all high fives. He was bouncing about chock full of energy.
It was possible, William reflected, that a mere different arrangement of the particulars of the scene or the details of the picture would be sufficient to modify or perhaps to annihilate its capacity for sorrowful impression.
Hello, Mr. Barth, Scott said.
On with the story, Barth said. On with the story.
He evidently thought we were in Baltimore to play writing games. He'd prepared a list of them and was quite anxious to play them with us. Before the end, we must play before the denouement, he said, referring, as he did so often, that quite anxiety-ridden day to all of experience as if it were a narratological experiment.
He tried to get us to do an exquisite corpse.
We were tired and had no interest in anything so violent.
He tried to get us to write about the travels of a coin from the coin's perspective.
It felt facile and vacuous. William crumpled his page up, and soon the other unknown followed.
He tried to get us to write about the sea. He encouraged us to write from the point of view of a sperm swimming.
William guffawed and told Barth he knew nothing of politics.
A little liqueur, medias ras, Barth said as he offered us some sickening melon concoction.
In better days, we would have had none of that. We would have smashed the foul-smelling bottle to the floor and demanded bookers. But these were not better days, and as far as we could tell, there were no other bottles in that wretched house. It was gut-wrenching, sugary sweet poison. It was like drinking medicine, suffering the taste of it, knowing full well that it wouldn't do the job. We passed it around. Scott held his nose.
I have had that for years, Barth said, as if it weren't obvious to us. That bottle could tell a few stories.
Dirk tried to politely hint that they were tired and in need of warm, dry beds.
To the sea, then, am I right, men? Some salty air for what ails you? Again we enter the archetypal epic of man and the sea, aye? Barth said and squinted his eye like a pirate.
We didn't want to be impolite. The guy had written like 40 books and we only had one hypertext novel. Itself impossible to hold.
William vomited 10 yards out from shore, and Barth called him a scurvy knave and said something about minding the topmast.
Scott said something about writer's block while Dirk tried and failed to write a poem about an albatross.
Writing is like following a wave, Barth said, and he looked meaningful, even mournful. The story is the ripple behind the wave, and we had no idea what he meant. And we are the foam on the ripple. Then he laughed and said, "Oh, mateys, a squall's coming in. The sea is all the stories wrapped in one." And he giggled. The Chesapeake Bay is an encyclopedia. He was laughing at his own jokes, if that's what they were. Or perhaps this was the onset of some sudden madness, the three of us trapped on a boat with him, Dirk vomiting now as well. A madness, a syrupy green, and this boat, our little dinghy, this boat is a comma, and Scott grew ill as well, globs of Midori projecting from his nose and out onto the deck. Life is all punctuation, Barth said, profound now, deeper now, and every ending is an ellipsis.
Thank you.
Buy our fucking book.
So that's all, but we'd like to empty all of the wine bottles before you leave in the next 20 minutes. Thanks very much.